We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with two veteran Washington observers, co-authors of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst for CBS News. His books include The Permanent Campaign and Its Future, The Broken Branch, How Congress is Failing America and How to Get It Back on Track with Thomas Mann, and most recently, the New York Times bestseller It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, which is co-authored by Thomas Mann, who is a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, where he holds the W. Averill Harriman Chair. A noted congressional scholar, Thomas Mann writes and speaks widely on American politics and policymaking, including campaigns, elections, campaign finance, reform, and the effectiveness of the Congress. His most recent books, co-authored again with Norman Ornstein, is It's Far Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann.
Thanks, Ian. Great to be with you.
Thank you. Happy to be with you.
And let me start with Norman. I recently hosted Buddy Romer and Rocky Anderson and a representative of Americans Elect to kind of explore the possibilities of third parties. And, of course, Buddy Romer just quit today. So when you're talking about American politics becoming polarized, which you do in your book, I was always led to believe that America is a centrist country, that politicians on the left and the right, they hug the left and the right in the primaries but move back to the center for the general. And that's where the kind of fulcrum, the center of gravity is in American politics. Yet nobody in the center can get arrested, right?
Well, I think, you know, there were many flaws in the Americans Elect approach. And in our book, Tom and I were pretty critical of them and the whole notion of a third party coming to the rescue. But a good part of the reason is that the theory here is that both parties have moved to the extremes, so there's this vast opening in the middle, when the reality is that one party has moved to the extreme and the other is occupying the center or center left. When you look at some of the people who have supported ardently the notion of a third party, like columnist Matt Miller with Roots in Los Angeles, basically a plea for a set of policies that are very similar to those that Barack Obama has pushed. And the idea that you could bring in a third party who might then contribute to electing an extremist in a three-way race, or at least damage the legitimacy of a winner, just doesn't make a lot of sense.
So you're suggesting then we have a centrist candidate, and that is President Obama.
Yeah, if you look at the health care bill that passed, it was basically the moderate Republican alternative from the early 1990s, melded with the Romney plan. You look at the budget plans that Obama has endorsed, including the Gang of Six plan in the Senate. They're centrist. There's no public option in the health care plan. I mean, the idea that this is a set of left-wing policies just is not true.
Again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst for CBS News, and Thomas Mann, who's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, where he holds the W. Averill Harriman Chair. They're co-authors of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. So, Thomas Mann, tell us about the concept that's in your book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. In other words, you're saying that both parties participate in tribal warfare, but both are not equally culpable, and that what we have now is asymmetrical polarization?
Yeah, it's so common for analysts, for reporters, for nonpartisan groups to say, well, the problem is the polarization of the parties. They've moved to extreme positions, and if we can just bring them both back toward the center to find a sort of golden mean between them, then we can take the steps necessary to deal with the serious problems confronting the country. The difficulty with that is it isn't true. There's just overwhelming evidence that the Republicans have really careened off the tracks, moved far to the right, embraced what by conventional standards would be considered radical changes in policy, and have embraced a kind of strategic view of competition with the other side that leads them to, for example, take the debt ceiling crisis or pseudo-crisis, put the full faith and credit of the United States at risk, to hold it hostage to achieve specific policy objectives. So it's both a sort of ideological movement to the right, but just as important, it's a strategic calculation about how their interests are best served. That means all-out opposition, no compromise, no negotiation. If they fail to use the filibuster to say to kill legislation, then anything they can do to discredit it or nullify it by filibustering appointees to serve in the agencies created by the law. So it's an all-out effort to take down the other side. Democrats are not angels, mind you. They're subject to the same incentives, but basically they believe in government, and they're not prepared to take it down or take down the economy. If you just look at the reaction of Democrats after George W. Bush was elected under very controversial circumstances in 2000, and compare that with Obama's decisive victory in 2008 and the reaction of the Republicans to his presidency, you see the difference. Yes, Democrats opposed, but they also came together on No Child Left Behind. Some of their members joined the president in supporting tax cuts for good or for evil. Many supported the decision to go to war in Iraq. But carry forward to the period of Barack Obama, and you will see explicitly they announced their strategy to engage in no dealings with this president. They needed to defeat him. That means to deny him success with the policies that might actually serve his political purpose, but which might also help the country.
Again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an Election Eve analyst for CBS News, and Thomas Mann, a noted congressional scholar who writes and speaks widely on American politics and policymaking, including campaigns, elections, campaign finance reform, and the effectiveness of Congress. Together, they've written this new book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. But just, Norman, just following on what Thomas was just saying, your book, which of course was preceded by an op-ed you wrote back in April in the Washington Post, Let's Just Say It, The Republicans Are the Problem, has fallen victim to the kind of binary notion that governs our press, where you have this convention of thesis, antithesis, synthesis. In other words, the pro, the con argument, and then this kind of meaningless mush that presupposes that in the universe of discourse there's two equal and opposite black and white opinions. And as Thomas was just saying, it was in fact a Tea Party tantrum that threatened the full faith and credit of the United States. However, it was not necessarily reported that way in the mainstream press. And you're not getting, either of you, getting any traction with this book in terms of the Sunday morning talk shows.
That's been an interesting phenomenon. We're going to make our first appearance this Sunday on Up with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. But the fact is, even after a number of people have pointed out in print and in other places that we haven't been on any of the Sunday shows, Meet the Press, Face the Nation, this week, or even the shows that deal with journalism, like Howie Kurtz's show on CNN, and this has been repeated all over the place, we haven't gotten a call from any of them. And frankly, the fact that they don't have either or both of us on as panelists is no big deal. What's equally interesting is that the topics that we've raised and that op-ed that you mentioned that was in the Post went absolutely explosively viral. It got more than 5,000 comments on the Post op-ed page within 24 hours of it being posted, which was 2 days before it was in print. We've now had over 250,000 Facebook referrals and over 1.5 million web hits on the piece. This was the subject of discussion all over Washington the Sunday that it appeared and all out throughout the next week. And they didn't even discuss it. None of the shows brought up these issues, and especially the issue of the press repeating false equivalence, saying it's all about reporting both sides of the story, not the, in many cases, what might be five or six sides of a story, but in particular, not focusing on what the truth is, rather than saying two sides are both have to be equal, which means a hit-and-run driver and a hit-and-run victim would be considered equivalent. This is really important stuff. We've gotten tons of emails and had personal conversations with top reporters in Washington who tell us that at least our book has now opened up a conversation in the newsrooms that many editors and even reporters were reluctant to have. But the idea that you'd actually discuss it in this way or even legitimize the idea that one side is more to blame than the other is anathema to an awful lot of these mainstream press outlets, I'm afraid.
And Thomas Mann, I mean, can we extrapolate now on that notion? Because it seems to me that what the press does in political races, particularly in presidential races, is that they level the playing field. And I think Romney's getting a fairly easy path, is he not? And as Thomas was saying earlier, the difference between the compromising and many say feckless Democrats who accepted the Supreme Court decision in Bush v. Gore and basically swallowed their indignation compared to how Obama has swept in with getting the trifecta, the Congress, the Senate, and the House, and he is treated like an illegitimate interloper.
Yeah, I mean, our point is not to say one candidate is being treated gently and the other harshly. We want to get at the more fundamental problem here, which is the press needs to be concerned about the truth of what is said and argued, the evidence, the accuracy. Instead, they're afraid if they do that, and it seems to favor one side or the other, that they'll be accused of partisan bias, and they're right. There are party operatives out there who will jump on them, but the problem then is that the public is misinformed. They're almost demobilized, disarmed. They said, oh, they're all involved in this. There's no difference. There's nothing we can do. Well, there are differences, serious differences, and yet the spin that passes for a reality and then the overwhelming emphasis on the candidates themselves and their personal qualities and the nature of the race and what's said today and what difference does it have on the polls. I mean, all that stuff is almost without any meaning and utility to an electorate that's trying to hold their elected officials accountable. So in its stress for balance and fairness, the press, and let me say it's true of other nonpartisan observers, it's true of many people in the academic world who study these things as well, to shy away from the truth. And I think that point that we made, and not coming from a partisan source, but rather from two people that had spent 40 plus years each working in a very straightforward way to try to approximate the truth, what was going on, has resonated with a large number of people in the country. We didn't expect this kind of reaction at all. It's really quite stunning, and I think, as Norm said earlier, conversations are moving forward. This isn't going to go away. I hope we've started something that will now move ahead on its own momentum, that others will enter the fray, and that we'll try to get some straight, accurate coverage, useful information to voters, and try to pull ourselves out of a very dysfunctional period in American public life.
Well, it seems to me, Norman, what Thomas is saying points to an even broader problem as a society. If we live in a society where the truth is a moving target, that there's no consensus about what's the truth, and if he who spins and counterspins the argument best wins it, and people do their own reality shopping, Christians get their information from Christian television, conservatives from Fox News, liberals from MSNBC, isn't that a very dangerous portent for a complicated and big society like that, like this one is, that there is no consensus?
Exactly so. And, you know, we talk at some length in the book about the demise of the public square. You know, we had for a significant period of time in this country, and it had its flaws for sure, three networks that were the primary source of news for the vast majority of Americans. We shared a common set of facts about the way the world worked, and then we debated, often hammer and tong, solutions to the problems that emerged. We're now in a very different kind of world, one where people cocoon into partisan media sources, but also rely on viral emails and blogs that can repeat things that are blatantly false over and over again. In many cases, they seem reasonable. They get sent from your closest friends and relatives all around, and when you get them, they have a surface credibility to them. And it leads people to believe things that are not necessarily true at all. We've seen that with a lot about climate change. We've seen it with the whole idea that the president is not legitimate because he wasn't born in the United States, something that now up to 40% of self-identified Republicans, and it varies from state to state, sometimes more, still believe. How can you negotiate with somebody who a very substantial share of voters and some members of Congress believe is not a legitimate president? It's a very difficult phenomenon, and of course we also live in a world where the culture has been debased so much that lies are not treated as shameful things. They're treated as wonderful ways to get additional television time or raise more money. And I must say, just watching Mitt Romney appear at a fundraiser with Donald Trump, who continues to spout the nonsense about Barack Obama's birthplace, and giving it a kind of legitimacy and refusing to repudiate it, only reinforces these worst instincts.
We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back continuing the conversation with Norman Ornstein and Thomas Mann.
Entertainment, we're still the pawns in their game.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. Again, I'm speaking with Norman Ornstein, who is a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an election eve analyst at CBS News. And also is joining us is Thomas Mann, a noted congressional scholar who writes and speaks widely on American politics and policymaking, including campaigns, elections, campaign finance reform, and the effectiveness of Congress. Together, they've written this brand new book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. So, Thomas, what Norman was just saying sort of strikes me as being perhaps a way to summarize it is that we live in the age of Karl Rove, and I'm curious about the role that Karl Rove is playing. On the one hand, in the last cycle in 2010, he was against some of the Tea Party candidates, particularly the one in Delaware, the one that practiced witchcraft, or at least said she did, or dabbled in it. But recently you had a Tea Party guy knock off a real long-time and highly regarded Senator Lugar in Indiana. I don't know that Rove's fingerprints were on that, but who's driving this agenda to put in these kind of take-no-prisoners Republicans?
Well, listen, the major party officials, the party, Republican Party establishment, has basically decided it's better to have the Tea Partiers within the party than outside, and so they have embraced them and encouraged them. At times, Rove and others have sided with a traditional Republican against a challenge in a primary from a Tea Partier who was seemed especially weak and might be vulnerable in the general election to a Democrat. But basically, Rove has trimmed his positions depending on what will work and what will sell. His instincts are to be critical of the insurgents, but his objective is to win. He's a very able political strategist and operative, and now he's working as head of and really coordinator of a large number of the so-called super PACs, independent spending only political action committees that often, in Rove's case and others, set up an affiliated 501c4 nonprofit organization as a means of preserving the anonymity of some of their large donors who don't want the publicity. They're engaged primarily in an effort to weaken Obama and to enter those critical House and Senate races where they feel they can make a difference. Their objective is first and foremost to have a unified Republican government. That's traditional. That's what party people do. But they have been extremely aggressive in using sort of new means of achieving those objectives. On the one hand, trying to diminish the electorate, particularly in sort of low socioeconomic status neighborhoods where they would presume Democrats would have more support, and in coming up with new ways in a regulated campaign finance system to operate without limits. It is an extremely hardball, permanent war campaign being waged to win, period. As far as what Rove is concerned, what they do afterwards is an issue to be dealt with as to how they deal with the Tea Partiers. But if you really look at the agenda of the party, the budget articulated by Paul Ryan, the Republican chair of the House Budget Committee, and look at Mitt Romney's campaign promises, you realize that it calls for a radical change. It's not a deficit reduction plan. We've got all kinds of expert and bipartisan, nonpartisan committees that have indicated what that would take. This is something fundamentally different. It's to cut taxes, not raise revenues, and over time, it's to shrink and eliminate substantial parts of the federal government.
So, Norman Ornstein, is there a psychological component to this? I mean, I sense that this sort of take no prisoners, no compromise mentality is driven by some kind of psychological momentum or core. And when you have people like Alan West, the congressman down in Florida, who says that there are, 80 communists in the Democratic Party, and nobody much gets up in arms about it. Michelle Bachmann said pretty much the same thing. Sarah Palin basically says she's an American, and people that don't agree with her are not real Americans. And this division that's happening seems to be driven by some kind of psychological quotient that I can't put my finger on. Yeah. But the passion is such that it makes you feel that, as we know, I don't want to belabor the election, but it is an election year. We're heading into an election where one party is highly motivated, particularly on the right, and the other party is pretty disillusioned on the left.
Well, I think one of the things that's happening is that some of the extreme tactics and comments that we're seeing from especially some of these outside groups, but from bombastic members like Alan West, may be creating a little bit more motivation for the left. And at the same time, some of the policies being pursued may do the same. I was watching some footage of Trent Franks, a Republican House member from Arizona, on the House floor today with this new bill that would basically make it more difficult for people to get abortions. The idea being that you can't choose the sex of a child as a prerequisite. Now, you know, we have all kinds of safeguards in place on this front, and the bill is designed in a way to intimidate women even more. But what Franks was doing was basically going after Asian American women in a way that I think will probably get more of them a little bit more agitated and upset and may convert some voters. But at the same time, I think your general point is right. People who are angry with the status quo, and in this case, more of them are angry with the status quo that identifies Barack Obama as president, tend to be more intense and more involved. And I think that's even more true on the right as a general matter. And right now, if we're looking for the key, I think it may be in the word tribal. I was just reading this wonderful other new book by Jonathan Haidt called The Righteous Mind, and kind of looking at different motivations in the minds of liberals and conservatives and others. And I think what you see is that perhaps at a gut level, Sarah Palin knows how to tap into some of these primal, this is our tribe against their tribe, this is our way of life being challenged, that if you look at how it's being reinforced by emails, by Fox News, which has, just aired a remarkably partisan short documentary on its morning news show, you look at what Rush Limbaugh says, all of that is designed to activate the people in a way that is different than, I think, what we've seen in quite a while.
Well, just in closing, let me give Thomas Mann the last word here and ask you about the psychological underpinning and the extent to which the Republican Party is actually becoming more like a Soviet kind of Stalinist party in its sense that it doesn't want to compromise, it just wants to destroy the other side. And, it feels in many ways that, on the other hand, the Democrats sometimes feel like a victim of a mugging that's running after the assailant saying, oh, by the way, here's my wallet,
Listen, one of the people we quote extensively in the book is a Republican who worked for 30 years on the Republican side of the aisle in Congress, Mike Lofgren, is it, Norm?
Lofgren, yeah.
Lofgren, who sort of chronicled the change in the Republican Party and the kind of autocratic characteristics it took on. He's apparently now finishing a book which will be out in August, which will document much more of this. Listen, libertarians don't, you know, presumably don't aspire to a big government Stalinist regime. So we need to be careful in the words we throw around and use. But I think it's fair to say that there really are a different set of values that are the center of gravity of each of the political parties, and they're, Norm cited one important piece of work on this. There are dozens of scholarly articles on this pointing out substantial differences, sort of more fundamentalist, more traditionally authoritarian in sentiments. It's not everyone. It's just that they tend to cluster more in the Republican Party. And right now, the key thing is their position. They see themselves as an insurgent outlier. They have identified the enemy, and all is fair in love and war. And this is war. And the ends justify the means, and that allows them to engage in tactics that certainly do not support the image of America as a model democracy. Let me put it that way. We have a lot to explain about our dysfunctional politics, and unless we're prepared to note the differences between the parties, then we're simply looking past the source of many of our difficulties.
Well, I thank you, Thomas Mann, for joining us here today, and Norman Ornstein. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Norman Ornstein, who's a senior fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a longtime observer of Congress and politics. He writes a weekly column for Roll Call called Congress Inside Out and is an Election Eve analyst for CBS News. And he is the co-author with Thomas Mann of It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism. And Thomas Mann's a senior fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, where he holds the W. Avril Harriman Chair. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Bye.